comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right. It's all right.
So hey everybody, welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines. I don't know if I introduce myself. I'm Eric Mann, the host of Voices. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. We call it Voices from the Frontlines, your national movement building show. 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. Streaming live on the web, which is great, at kpfk.org. Again, we urge you to send emails to info@thestrategycenter.org and to eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com. And to tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks if you have ideas about Michael Brown, Ferguson, and where to go. Robin Kelly, it's very good to have you on the show.
It's always great to talk to you, Eric, always.
You know, Robin, I've been going back and forth. I've read your article about four or five times. Would you be willing to read the last two paragraphs? Because I think this pushes us right to the edge of demand development, and there's also an incredibly beautiful other sections.
Sure, the last two paragraphs. Okay, so in light of Missouri's failure to indict Darren Wilson for the murder of Mike Brown, calling for the withdrawal of the police, even temporarily, is a reasonable demand for people terrorized by state violence and feeling particularly vulnerable over their safety. They want law and order, but the police have shown a consistent disrespect for the law, flagrantly violated the Constitution, and operated with little to no accountability. Instead, the police operate as a rogue outfit. Their actions create disorder and fear. Furthermore, failure to indict effectively exonerates the police force, providing a pretext for the police to ramp up violence and repression in response to the legitimate expression of anger and frustration over the government's failure to protect black lives and ensure justice. It is already happening in the aftermath of the grand jury's decision as riot police invade the headquarters of Hands Up United as well as designated safe spaces. The young organizers in Ferguson from Hands Up United, Lost Voices, Organization for Black Struggle, Don't Shoot Coalition, Millennial Activists United, and the like, understand they are at war. Tef Poe, Tori Russell, Montega Simmons, Cheyenne Green, Ashley Yates, and many other young black activists in the St. Louis area have not been waiting around for an indictment, nor are they waiting for the much-vaunted federal probe, for they have no illusions about a federal government that provides military hardware to local police, builds prisons, kills tens of thousands by manned and unmanned planes without due process, and arms Israel in its illegal wars and occupation. They have been organizing. So have the young Chicago activists who founded We Charge Genocide in the Black Youth Project, in the Los Angeles-based youth who make up the Community Rights Campaign, and the hundreds of organizations across the country challenging everyday state violence and occupation. And I meant to put the Dream Defenders in there because they're a very important organization. They remind us not only that black lives matter, that should be self-evident, but that resistance matters. It matters because we are grappling with the consequences of settler colonialism and racial capitalism and patriarchy. It mattered in post-Katrina New Orleans, a key battleground in neoliberalism's unrelenting war on working people, where black organizers led multiracial coalitions to resist the privatization of schools, hospitals, public transit, public housing, and dismantling public sector unions. The young people of Ferguson continue to struggle with ferocity, not just to get justice for Mike Brown or to end police misconduct, but to dismantle racism once and for all, to bring down the empire, to ultimately end war.
Yeah, it was really great, Robin. And I think one of the things that we're seeing, I was thinking about this today, is that the written word is a very important part of movement building at this point. And one of the things I was thinking about is in terms of this question of, first of all, talking about the system and what does that mean, but then translating it into demands. Because sometimes people could say it's a capitalist system and try the killer cop. But the question of, let's deal with the issue of the police out of the black community. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Right. I have to say that the idea is an old one. I mean,
that's right.
It's a very old one. From your days early on as a young man struggling, you know that one of the demands of whether you're talking about the Black Power, the Black Panther movement, Black Panther Party, or the Black Power movement more generally, the community-based organizations felt that the police were an occupying force, a threat, and that the issue of public safety is something that, as a community, they can handle. Some stopgap measures would be something basic like ensuring that if you're going to have a police force, that police officers actually live in your community, engage your community, for example. If you're going to have a police force, have oversight. But the idea that we need the police, we take that for granted. Like somehow it's just a natural thing. The history of the modern urban police force is barely like 100-plus years old. You know, people have gone for
right.
for centuries without police. There's another very interesting article in Counterpunch by Peter Linebaugh called Beauty and Police, where he actually found some evidence that in Toledo in the early 20th century, they actually disarmed the police. The mayor said, you know, the police don't need guns. And in fact, they came up with a form of restorative justice in which the wealthiest of them gave more money to help out the person who committed the crime. You know, I mean, this is the sort of thing that is all possible. Not every police force in the world is armed. But let me get back to the main point. That is, I had the privilege of meeting with many of these same activists I mentioned in Ferguson about a month ago. And one of the issues that came up was, you know, we need 48 hours of civil disobedience all around the country, you know, when the non-indictment comes down. But we also need to create safe space, to create spaces in our communities in Ferguson and parts of St. Louis where the police are simply not allowed, you know. And so that was the discussion taking place among those activists. How do we actually keep the police out so that we can feel safe and protected? Because the police clearly, not just Ferguson, not just in St. Louis, everywhere, they don't recognize any kind of rule of law. You know, I mean, whatever we talk about the limitations of law, they're not even operating within them. And, you know, when you look at the collaboration, if you will, you know, between, you know, someone like Robert McCullough and, you know, the prosecutor and his assistants and the police itself, that they actually are in cahoots to make sure that no police officer is indicted. And once you do that, there are no checks and balances, nothing stopping them from their rogue behavior and from taking people's lives.
The voice you're listening to is Robin G.G. Kelly. He's a professor at UCLA, author of many books, and author of this really important, I'm calling it Why We Can't Wait, but that's not what it is. I got to get it is Why We Won't Wait, which is a move off Dr. King's Why We Can't Wait. And there's so many issues here, Robin, I want to talk about. I think one of the things I'm thinking about, you know, we're all staying up late trying to figure out, so where is this all going, you know? And I think that pushing in the strongest possible demands on the police, the strongest structural demands to just get them in the conversation, because I think there's a tremendous interest in this, but there's a perception right now that the community has moved very far to the right, the Black community, about police, but not if people are not putting it out. And I think we know that putting out a demand, you know, we have a campaign now, it's called No Cars in OA, No Tanks in OA, No MTA Apartheid Passes in OA, mm-hmm. and Not One More Deportation in OA. And just for 1 minute, I will go back to you, is that I was at a conference called Climate Resolve, where it is overwhelmingly white people who really care about global warming. And I said, well, on a human rights level first, do you know that the MTA has armed sheriffs collecting tickets on the very public transportation that you claim you support, and that since the 90% of the passengers are Black and Latino, there's a literal armed police state on the trains in which every single passenger is a suspect.
Right.
And if you're lucky, you find your pass. If you don't, you could be subject to interrogation, deportation, humiliation, and police violence. So what I'm getting to is the pervasiveness. We've been talking about the social welfare state, not the police state. And I think going frontally against the police state, which is what your article does, is, I think, the right conversation right now.
Right. No, I completely agree. In fact, if you just look at the last 15 years, I'm struck by how much more pervasive and present the police state is. That, you know, we see it, like the work that you all did with the Community Rights Campaign, and I mean, that basically exposed the presence of the police state in schools. And so your campaign to get the police out is incredibly important. If you look at, like you said, public transportation, if you look at just basic status violations and how people are being cited and arrested and fined over the most minor violations, violations that were at one point not violations at all. And if you look again at Ferguson, one of the ways that the police state imposes itself is in the constant citations. Again, much like the school police and LAPD, where people are getting citations for seatbelt violations, for not mowing your lawn, for very minor things. And what happens is these violations, these tickets, they add up, they turn into a warrant. And there are more warrants for arrest in Ferguson than there are people. What you've basically done is you've criminalized an entire population and put them within a system before they've even been incarcerated. They're basically preparing the way. And so imagine what it means for all those young people, older people to come out and confront the police knowing that they probably have warrants.
Exactly. On the show shortly after the first round of Ferguson, we had some young people from Organization of Black Struggle, and they talked about just what you said about the 33,000 arrest warrants to a population of just over 21,000. And I want to add that in our conversations with the MTA police, they said, well, 70% of the arrests we make on the train start by asking people for their pass. And they were trying to make the case that there's an underlying criminal element. And I said, sure, because you just provoked all these people who were minding their own business sitting on a train. As you pointed out, the only thing you were looking for, allegedly, was their pass. And very quickly, you found out a way to either find a warrant on them. So my point is the relationship between all these fines and all this police brutality is very scary stuff, because one opens the door for the other. Go back to your meetings with the people, the young people in St. Louis. You and I have been discussing this in a long time. Did you see any changes in attitude, or what were some of the conversations going on among them?
Right. Well, there were sort of two meetings going on at once. There was a sort of meeting of solidarity, support, and then there was a meeting which I was privileged to be invited to, of just the St. Louis-based, Ferguson-based organizers. And what I thought was really quite stunning is the age, with the exception of members of Organization of Black Struggle, which has been around, Organization of Black Struggle has been around for 40 years. But some of these people, some of these were really kids, like this 15-year-old kid who had never organized before, but they had an analysis. In other words, they tried to connect what they were doing in the streets for 100 days with what the long-term objective was, but more importantly, what was their critique of why the circumstances were the way they was. And they didn't fall back onto the most obvious things, like the police are racist. They knew that, but they understood what the structural dimensions of how racism operated. And so for them, it was kind of frustrating because they knew that the kinds of demands that were put forward, they knew that there were stopgap demands. They knew that pushing for a federal investigation is very important, but they knew that wouldn't solve the problem. And out of those conversations, they began to think about things like our schools, jobs, taxes, property taxes, tax bases. I mean, what does any of this stuff mean in terms of developing a new economy? We never got to the point of actually discussing something as basic as socialism. Because, I mean, and just because we didn't have enough time, but imagine how close a step. When you live in a world where everything's becoming privatized, when you are being surveilled because you don't have a bus ticket or a train ticket, when in fact a more logical way of running things would be to have all free public transportation and
exactly,
and then tax the wealthy to support a basic infrastructure. That's not socialism, that's a transitional way of thinking about it. But why should public transportation, schools, roads, even basic things like food, shelter, why should people pay for that? What's the production how do poor people come into being? I mean, in a place like St. Louis that has a rich history of industrial organizing, of militancy, how did St. Louis become a place full of poor people? And so for those young people to kind of ask the question, for them to even know that history is quite a stunning thing for them, And I have to say,
Hold on, Robin, just hold it for one more minute. Folks, as we're talking right now, we want you to start going to the phones, 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. Again, we encourage people of all races, but we hope that we would give priority to our black listeners, many of whom are our listeners are black, because this is a particular, again, day of pain and resistance in the black community, but we want to hear all your voices, 818-985-5735, and Robin and I will respond in about 5 minutes. I just wanted to have our listeners know, 818-985-5735, in about 5 minutes, we're going to go to the phones. Go ahead, Robin.
Right. Just the last thing I was going to say was that all the reports about the generational divide, I think, were greatly exaggerated. There were a lot of reports that young people were not willing to take leadership from elders, that they dismissed the civil rights generation, et cetera. And what I found wasn't a generational divide as much as a class divide, a very clear class divide, that a lot of the young people and older people were saying we need a strategy that attends to those people who are left out, to the homeless, to the youth who are associated with gangs, to the youth who have never been enfranchised, rather than have the same old negotiators. People negotiate with the city fathers, do their jobs, for them to take the streets and hold the streets. That was their position. That wasn't a generational thing as much as a class issue.
Well, I'm going to end with this, Robin. As we go to the phones, 818, we have a couple of callers already, 818-985-5735. The reason we've been focusing so much on demands is because it gets to a focus for the movement. In the leaflet we sent out, it said, hands off Ferguson, defend the right to protest and demonstrate, stand up to the military, police, and surveillance state, support the Ferguson movement's rules of engagement. We support black movement leaders bringing charges of national oppression, state violence, human rights, and genocide to the United Nations, amnesty and open borders for immigrants, national and human rights, and the right of self-determination for black and Latino people, and stop the U.S. and L.A.'s war against the planet, no cars in L.A., open borders and amnesty for immigrants, free the U.S. 2.5 million prisoners, stop U.S. drone attacks, fight for the right to protest and organize, no tanks in Ferguson, no tanks in L.A. And I think trying to provide some leadership to the movement that we must focus on demand development is an important breakthrough, more than even the specific demands. And at 440, 818-985, the phones are ringing. Let's go. What I'm going to do is, folks, we want 2 minutes each, and you're great at that, and I'm going to take two people, and then Robin and I will respond, or maybe even three. So, Roy in Los Angeles.
Hey, Eric. Thank you for letting me have this call. Listen, we sit we're not sitting on our hands. What we have been moved out of our comfort zone. When I say our comfort zone, our areas, the areas that we live in, has been bombarded and invaded by all the different nationalities, and everybody has been promoted to a degree over us that they have now considered us as non-essential people. And Eric, let me tell you this, because I went out there today about 1:30, something or 2, for that so-called march on Crenshaw and King Boulevard.
Right.
And Telemundo was a person. He ran the camera, not the camera, but he had two trucks out there. And this person is the one who started that march out there. He passed out signs, giving signs to black individuals to protest with. What does Telemundo has to do, whether we march against the city, whether we protest against the city? I hope you understand my reason for bringing this to you.
And Roy, let me respond to you really quick, because and thank you for calling Voices from the Front Lines. I guess what I'm confused about is that, isn't that a great thing? I mean, the fact that the Latino community is rallying around Michael Brown, is rallying around Ferguson. We want, Telemundo has an enormous listenership. But let me say something that I know Roy is saying that we got to say explicitly, which is his main point, that the system does feel that black people are expendable, has forced black people out of every job area, every neighborhood. There's nothing that black people can hold on to. And his sense of being under siege, not just by the police, but by the whole system, Roy, we totally agree with. And we want to thank you, brother, and stay in touch with us, okay? Fianna, Los Angeles.
Yeah, hi. There were two things I wanted to say. The first one was there was a specific direction of poor people in St. Louis, and I feel like it just needs to be said that there are poor people everywhere. I mean, I'm from Detroit. I have family that still lives there, and it's a sad state there. I obviously live in Los Angeles now. There are lots of poor people here. This is a systemic problem in the entire country, and I feel like, you know, this Michael Brown situation has created a spotlight on St. Louis, but it's everywhere. That's the first thing. The second thing...
Well, we're going to stay on your first thing, because that's how much time we have. Robin, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, no, there's no question that there are poor people everywhere, not just in the United States, but all over the globe. This is the immiseration of capitalism. And Michael Brown certainly has drawn some attention to the struggle against police repression. Detroit and the struggle against water privatization has also brought other kinds of attention to the poor. I think the question is, what are we going to do? What are our demands to basically end poverty, to make basic needs fulfilled and things accessible, housing, water, safety? This is just fundamental. And what's happened in this kind of neoliberal order is that the numbers of the poor just grow, and grow.
I'm going to hold you there, Robin. Habu in Wisconsin. Thank you for being in Wisconsin.
Yes, thank you very much for the opportunity, and I'll say it in 1 minute. Let's just focus on the police aspect, and there are many aspects to it, but this is what I bring here to the table, and that is the badge indemnifies these police and the police departments from this misconduct that they are having, meaning that they are indemnified criminally, and secondly, they are indemnified financially, meaning we taxpayers, through our property taxes, pay for the raise in insurance premiums, which are made for payouts. So even the financial stuff, if you stop that, these guys will have a change of heart in a New York minute.
Well, Habu, thank you for being in Wisconsin and listening live on the web. Kobe Bryant said today that they asked him what he thought, and he says, until you change the system, they're going to quit them all the time because the laws are written to let the police off, which I thought was pretty good, Kobe. So Martin in Los Angeles. Yes, Martin.
Is it too early or too naive or both to expect out of this any meaningful form of reliable and continuous leadership into the foreseeable or unforeseeable future?
Well, let me try to take that quick. I mean, the struggle for leadership yesterday, for instance, and thank you for the question, Martin, 818-985-5735. Last night, I left Leimert Park at about 8, and the members of the Labor Community Strategy Center and the Bus Riders Union, Youth Justice Coalition, YJC, some people from Black Lives Matter, other groups, got together and just started marching, and they didn't know exactly where they were going to march. They ended up blocking traffic. They ended up going to different police stations and building a movement. They had over 100 people, and then when they came back to Leimert Park, there were several hundred people who had not been there at first. So my answer is yes, there is new leadership coming forth. And these young people are not simply, as Robin was saying, they're not just angry. They're getting some theory and they're getting some practice. Charlene and Maria and Del Rey, and then Rafael and San Fernando, 818-985-5735. Hi, Charlene. This is Eric Mann and Robin Kelly.
Yeah, there were so many mistakes made, but I have to go to Michael Brown because now we know his robbery of the shop of the $50 box of cigarillos did play into the policeman's state of mind. And Michael Brown did grab for the officer's gun, and his blood is actually on the gun that the officer put in an evidence bag. My point is that Michael Brown, as I go back to a Jane Austen kind of thing from Elizabeth Bennet, had he behaved in a more gentlemanly manner, he would be alive today. He never should have grabbed in.
Okay, Charlene, I wanted you to be able to make your point clearly. I don't want to even debate that. I think Jane Austen is not relevant, or is only sadly relevant to your remarks, but thanks a lot. Robin, you want to say something on that?
Very, very quickly. There are a couple of things. One is that there is no evidence except for what the prosecutor planted that Darren Wilson actually knew Mike Brown had been involved in the robbery. But he knew that a robbery had taken place. You know, it took a long time to kind of put those things together, and there's no evidence that he actually knew. But let's just say that he did know. There's something called the rule of law. And in the rule of law, the U.S. Supreme Court made a decision, Tennessee versus Garner, that basically says that even if someone commits a felony, if that person is unarmed and fleeing, if that person doesn't, you know, maybe fighting you, but doesn't have a weapon, and doesn't have the kind of capacity to apply lethal force to you as the police officer holding the gun, that technically you're taking that person's life is an illegal seizure.
So we'll stay right there. Listen, folks, we're running off the hook. I'll tell you what I'm going to do. No comments for us. Let's use every single last minute from the listeners. Rafael in San Fernando, I will run the list. We got about 10 people there, and it's growing. 818-985-5735. Rafael, you got a minute. Say whatever you want to say.
Yes, thank you. And I really appreciate the opportunity to share my comments with you guys. Yes, being from Central America and being used to the point being used to police brutality in those countries, you can hear and you see that things are not different.
Rafael, we have to move. We're having trouble hearing you. Romeo in Riverside?
Good afternoon. Thank you for letting me on your show.
Of course.
I think it's a youth problem. The police see youth and they just assume that they're doing something incorrectly. We can see this with, like, Justin Bieber, because he has money, the police were escorting the clubs. Once they got looked at, they want to go harass him. Now, whether he deserved it or not, I don't care. But it's a youth problem, you know, and with poor people, they put you in the system, and now you're trapped in the system.
Thanks a lot, Romeo. Out. That's great. We're going to move on to John from San Diego. We'll make sure everybody gets in.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking the call. And
you're on Voices from the Front Lines. Go ahead, John.
Pardon me? Oh, hi. Thanks for taking the call. And, well, you're probably not going to like my comments, but I think that Michael Brown was actually a thug and a bully. He stole from the store owner.
Listen, this is Free Speech Radio. You already made your point. Celia in California. Celia?
Oh, yes, I'm here.
I'd like to hear your point of view.
Yeah, my point of view is there are always going to be bad apples with these police officers. But once there are no consequences for their action, they will continue to do what they do to people of color. If there are consequences, there will be small amount of peace of these police officers that are making the good police officer look bad.
Thank you.
That's
so much. Thank you, Celia. Fred in Long Beach.
Yeah, anyone that thinks there's a different races is a racist. We have to realize there's only one race, the human being race, and we have to judge people by their actions, like Martin Luther King said, not by the color of their skin. As long as you keep keeping this as a race issue, we're going to never have any solutions. We have to look at it as a cultural problem and based on economic status.
Thank you, Fred.
And we have to,
Fred, you made it's a good point again. You made it. Jamie in Canyon Lake.
Hi. I just did 4 years in the Marine Corps, and we're given rules of engagement, and police officers are given the same thing. That cop, his gun was being reached for. He had absolutely every right to shoot.
Okay, Jamie, thank you very much. Really, we heard your point. David in Burbank.
Thanks for taking my call. I just I live in L.A., and I've been seeing a lot of police brutality, whether this has been always going on since the beginning and it was just not exposed to the public. I just think, people with a badge are taking an advantage of the power that they're given in certain circumstances, and I think it's wrong, and it should come to an end. Now, that doesn't say that...
That's good, David. Everybody, listen, if you're getting the sense of the pace, open with your main point, and we're letting you get your main point. Randall in Los Angeles, 818-985-5735. We got at least three other callers, so keep going. 818-985-5735. You're on Voices from the Frontline with Eric Mann and Robin Kelly. Randall, what do you have to say?
Yeah, I think that the laws are just skewed and they need to change. I think what needs to happen is that on any police force in America, white officers should not be allowed. It should be against the law to basically fire a gun at an African American. And
that's a great precedent.
We will have no.
That's great. We heard your point. That's your main point. That's great. Mary in Los Angeles.
Hi, I'm white, and I'm getting really upset at some of these callers. I know they're white, and they don't understand. They have white privilege, and they're blind to it. And I'm just outraged that they aren't outraged that cop initiated this. And no matter what that young man did, he didn't deserve to be shot. He didn't do anything wrong.
That's and Mary, I'm going to hold you right there, because Rob and I think we both want to say something. The listenership to KPFK is very multiracial. We've had a lot of, on the Trayvon Martin case, we've had a tremendous number of black calls. I have to say, it's free speech radio, but we have heard some of the most racist, chauvinist, abusive voices justifying police brutality against black people, and I know that that's not what the vast majority of our listeners think, but it is refreshingly terrifying.
Right.
To hear that level of confidence to speak into this microphone. Robin?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that it also tells us what kind of work we have to do, because as the young woman from the Marines said, we have rules of engagement, and she just proved the point that the police are the domestic arm of the U.S. military, and this is war.
Well, we're going to stay with us, Robin, because I like our comments better than some of the phones. We have 2 minutes. I'd rather you just have the last 2 minutes, Robin. Anything you want to say to just even clear the air of some of this white chauvinism would do good for a lot of our listeners.
Well, we've moved in interesting directions, but I have to say I'm very optimistic because... some of the young white organizers who have been participating, not just in Ferguson, but all over the country, have actually begun to take leadership from people of color and have tried to develop not just an anti-capitalist critique, but an anti-racist one, because they recognize that racism is not biology, but it's structure. You know, it's myth, but it's material. And they understand that, and they're fighting to end that. And that's the generation we need to support. And maybe one of these days we might be able to have conversations free of racism. I'm not in my lifetime, but that would be great.
And let me add that, and you know, because of the skew of the particular calls we got, is a black man from ran for president of the United States in 2008. He was perceived as the race candidate, the peace candidate, the woman's candidate, the gay candidate. And over 50% of white voters between the age of 18 and 29 voted for Barack Hussein Obama, leaving aside who Barack Hussein Obama turned out to be. That is a phenomenal breakthrough in our lifetime, Robin, don't you think?
Yes, it is. Definitely. Definitely.
And keep reading. I want to end by thanking Counterpunch, because Counterpunch is pretty amazing. Robin, myself, we all write for Counterpunch. Go every day on counterpunch.org or counterpunch.com. It comes up, I think, on both. Read it every day. I urge you to read Robin Kelly's article, which is the lead article today. Beautifully, beautifully written and crafted. You just have to read it. And I want to thank, of course, our guests. But Robin, I just want to say thank you so much for all the work you do. And we'll be in touch soon. And I want to say, see you next Tuesday. This is Voices from the Frontlines, all power to the people.